Welcome to the TAP One-on-One podcast, hosted by Sean Gange Harris. In this podcast, we go deeper one-on-one with the people who bring you technology, who create innovation, and help your business grow. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to the TAP One-on-One podcast, where the people who participate in technology, innovation, and growth, we get to know much better. I'm Sean Gange Harris, and our guest today is Rodney Frank. If you've listened to or watched the Technology Innovation Growth podcast, then you're familiar with Rod. He's the guy who I think it would be fair to say is having an easy job of resisting the siren song of the Cuyahoga and Cleveland in general.
Doing my best. It's hard.
Yes, no doubt. You can see both of their buildings if you go there. He has a long history of excellence in technology and technology architecture. He's worked on numerous highly impactful technology implementations, from wrench twisting to creating high-level architecture and guiding strategies. Hello, Rodney. How are you today?
I'm well, sir. How are you?
Doing well. Doing as well as this corona thing will allow, I guess.
True enough.
We're hoping to get to an end to this, you know, this year sometime, but I just don't know anymore.
Exactly. We'll keep the fingers crossed.
knock on wood, right?
Yeah, you bet.
So in an effort to get to know you better, let me start with Rod or Rodney. What's preferred for you?
Rod is sort of the easy one, obviously. Yeah.
Just don't call you late for dinner.
That's the important one. You bet.
I'm with you there. I'm strongly in that camp. Call me what you want. Just don't call me late for supper. So the first question I guess I really have is, you know, when did your interest in technology begin?
Well, my dad was a salesman for like heavy industrial fans. He brought home his first computer when he got given a laptop at work, and it was a 286 laptop with a monochrome screen. And what he brought home was his PCXT from IBM. The only thing that was on that was Tetris and QBasic, which was sort of Microsoft's first programming language.
Wow. That's quite a while ago, and I won't date myself by saying I was well alive to see those days. I was possibly too old to admit to that type of thing. Anyway, my father was a technophile, brought home technology, and yeah, it just kind of sticks.
And where that ended up sort of leading me along the path of was he would bring home his laptop at night and I would break it. He'd have troubles the entire next day. IT wasn't what it was today. You couldn't just call the help desk. He'd bring it home and slap it on the table and say, "Fix it. I don't know what you did last night, but fix it." So, you know, that was the introduction to wrench twisting 101. It was, you know, here's a laptop, you know, high mem, you've been playing with EMM 386, batch files, sys files, all these like highly technical things that Microsoft came out with to boost your performance on your hardware. From there, that was what piqued my interest in computers. I started getting under the hood, kind of like a little mechanic and figuring out how these things worked.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
I'm familiar with all of those things as well. Have you always worked in IT, or have you done anything outside of IT and technology?
So technically, when I left high school, I spent a year as a landscape architect. Totally outside of technology. But what ended up happening as a result of that was the boss, you know, heard from through the grapevine, you know, "I hear you've got some techie type skills, and I've just bought a sand and gravel pit. And I need to get my accounting software working on more than one machine currently it's on one desktop. My wife does the accounting. I need more than one accounting person now, and I'm not sure how to do that." So he said, you know, if you're keen, let me know what you need, books, cables, crimpers, you know, whatever you need, just let me know. And we'll purchase the little pieces as we go over the wintertime. And hopefully by springtime, when things kick back up again, we'll be in good shape. And that literally was my foray into work in IT. It was total coincidence. You know, I wasn't really planning it, but it's where I ended up.
Right. Yeah. That's kind of the infancy of IT for most people.
You bet.
So when that happened, how long before, and I guess you just kind of muddled through it, you just kind of figured it out, trial and error. I mean, there was no real internet to speak of, I guess, at that particular time.
Yeah, lots of bulletin boards and things like that. We used to do dial-up, and I remember the first email message I sent from Calgary to Toronto took the same sort of 4 days that Canada Post would have taken to get there. But it was that was sort of one of the sparks. It was something called FidoNet back then.
Right.
And it was literally one computer dialed another one and sent a little piece of mail, and then another one dialed another one and sent a little piece of mail, and eventually it would hop across the country and get to where it was going. But yeah, definitely sort of infancy of the internet, pre-internet days. Yeah.
Right. So in that environment, it seems like it would be awfully tough to learn, as opposed to now. So how did you manage that challenge? And second off, at what point was there skills or classes or some sort of organized educational process?
Well, so I think, in the very early days, it was fairly hands-on. Like I would partner myself with various people who had slightly better skills than me. In the evening times, I'd hit up some of my friends who had evening classes at the university, you know, pick up a few extra little tricks and tips from the university. And then eventually sort of the Microsoft MCSE kind of came into my purview, and that was sort of the start of the, I guess, industry-based training that I sort of undertook. So back when the MCSE was sort of NT4, Windows 2000 kind of era, that was when there was a big boom in MCSEs. Everybody and their dog was sort of trying to figure out how to become an MCSE.
Right.
And I was lucky to be on the early edge of that. So the quality of the training and stuff was still very high. Microsoft hadn't, you know, sort of broadened the reins enough to kind of lose on some of those higher level skills that you needed. And then from there, it was industry specific after that. I did a little contract up at the Airport Authority, helping them migrate from NT4 to 2000. Used a bit of Novell skills back then too. All their servers and stuff were all Novell at the time. So I helped them through that transition from Novell over to Windows. Once you start down that path, once you sort of have that introduction to Microsoft and whatever, then from there's a ton of courses that start to open themselves up. It was quite a number of years before I started getting into the architecture side of the education, but I think that was also a bit of a journey from an IT perspective. I don't think, you know, architecture was around back then, but it was very much in the purview of like Department of Defense or, Industry Canada, you know, the big government or public institutions really required strict architectural rules in order to be able to implement IT systems. So, it took quite a while before that stuff became more mainstream.
Right. It was pretty much the sole domain of the IBMs or the, you know, the Microsofts of the world internally. It wasn't, and even Microsoft, I say that, but they didn't have a strong basis in that either. For those who are not familiar with the IT world or the IT evolution, obviously in that 1998-99 there was a huge boom in the IT segment. Maybe you could kind of elaborate on why there was such a big boom.
Yeah, back then, and sort of to preface that, I started into this industry right in sort of the 96 to 98 was kind of that ramp up period for me. And during that 98, 2000, somewhere in there, there was this huge ramp up that was a combination of things, really. It was the growth of sort of Silicon Valley and the things that were happening there. You know, you'd have Sun Microsystems, you know, right next door to Yahoo, and then whatever that cross-pollination looked like. And down the street was Hitachi with their big storage systems and things. And so, like, there was all these tech companies all conglomerating around that Silicon Valley area. So there's a lot of that happening. And then in addition to that, there was the Y2K bug. So you were getting all these, you know, Fortran programmers who had been, you know, out of work for years because, well, that's just the nature of Fortran. and people that were actively, you know, using other skill sets at that point who had transitioned to other languages and things like that, all coming back to the scene to try and sort of repair this unforeseen bug that kind of existed back then with two-digit dates versus four-digit dates. And right. So there was a huge influx of new talent, people that were just there. You know, I remember one of my friends out of high school into university, he got hired for a summer contract to help with Y2K audit. So he had to go around to everybody's workstation and document what programs were being used and how much RAM and how much CPU was it running. And they compiled all these big lists, and then they'd go back to the IT shop and they'd say, so here's the list. What on this list actually needs to be remediated and what is safe to go, essentially.
Right.
So, yeah, all of those types of things were happening back in the late 90s. And, you know, a lot of the larger organizations, the IBMs, the HPs and stuff were moving into big business. It was no longer just the domain of sort of accounting people to be working in the computers now. Sure. They had salespeople and they had developers and they were making databases and things like that. So, you know, all of these things combined together to just turn into a bit of a bubble.
Right, right. So obviously in 2000, when the big boom didn't happen, it turned out to be much ado about nothing. At that point, for the uninitiated, many people, at least in Canada, and I can speak to this pretty clearly, many people who were in restaurant and hospitality that I knew went into technology, whether they had a technology base or not. They went into that, as you alluded to, the Microsoft training or the Novell training, Novell for me specifically. And we had a big influx of people who, had customer service background, but were just new to technology. Now, that kind of wave died out. And most of those people have since moved on and found the next biggest thing. But now we're back to people who are, you know, kind of long-term technology people and who have, a pretty defined focus. So this is a long way around to asking the question about how did you get to, before architecture, or maybe it was architecture, but how did you get to that broader view of how to help customers or deploy technology? Because I view it as somewhat of a realm outside of people who have focused on just developing technology solutions or just deploying technology solutions for the most part.
Sure. Yeah. So, during that career progression, I slowly obviously got more senior and senior with the roles that I was taking on. And the one thing that kept coming up the world is full of patterns and full of, what's old is new again, things like that. The one thing that I kept seeing was this constant disconnect. You know, you're watching a movie like Back to the Future 2, and you're seeing this future of flying cars and things like this. And then you look at the reality of where people are in that process of getting to flying cars. And you're like, you look at your grandfather and he's like, well, I was told this internet thing's supposed to have every mechanics book in the known to mankind, and I should be able to fix any kind of car. And, you know, he's using web crawler and he's looking for these manuals and stuff, and they're not out there yet. I mean, there was this disconnect between, you know, what people wanted versus what they were able to understand, I guess, is almost the other side of it. Right. And so it took a while for people to really buy into technology, understand the process of technology. And that was a real barrier. And that was what really drove me towards architecture, was how do we in IT or in technology, how do we start to be translators for the average layperson? You know, we're talking about EMM 386s and BAT files and SIS files and all of this stuff that nobody really understands, but they need to have at least a rudimentary understanding of them in order to get beyond that and start looking at flying cars. So,
right.
So Back to the Future sparked my, my interest in architecture and in how do we act as translators in that space and help people understand the value of the transition that they need to go through to get to that next evolution of computer. And, you know, it's not all about artificial intelligence and 3D this and, you know, all these big things that are out there now. In a lot of cases, it's even more basic than that. It's how do I plug in two computers and make them talk on the internet together?
Right.
And those might be the very basic fundamental things that a company is trying to solve, and they just don't understand, you know, enough about what IT is putting in front of them. Why should it cost this much, or why, you know, why these technologies and not something else? So right. that was the piece, I think, that did it for me, was figuring out that translator role.
Right. Right. And as technology changes, and as we all know, technology changes a lot and very quickly. One of the biggest changes was obviously the proliferation of fast internet connections. So not just the internet, because people like I suspect you, but myself had internet, and we had dial-up connections that were honestly painfully slow. And it's, you know, it's a miracle we got anything done. But now we've got these crazy internet connections at home or in offices. And that, you know, provides some real opportunities. But then, you know, you kind of touched on it in that it also provides some challenges in that people go, you know, I just want these two computers and they're on the internet. Why can't they talk to each other? Do you find you have strategies for helping people, you know, understand why things can't work or why they're as expensive as they are? And, you know, are people able to relate to that? Or are you finding new ways to help them relate to that?
Yeah, you know, a lot of that started in that sort of digital age where people were moving from these analog dial-up connections over to things like broadband internet, you know, ADSL and cable modems and things like that. I remember specifically at that time, I was working for a company here in Calgary called CADvision, which was sort of one of the first internet service providers out there. And we did an install at this lady's house, and the technician went in there, he put in the little network card and connected her up and did his download tests and everything looked great on the line. It was a beautiful, nice and close to the central office where the bandwidth was coming from, and it was great. And so he walked off site, said thank you very much, we'll see you later. And before he had even made his way back to the office, she was on the phone saying, you know, this connection is so slow, like it's just as slow as my dial-up was. And I don't understand, you know, this is supposed to be an always-on connection, super fast, you know, 10 times faster than my current dial-up kind of situation, but it's just not working for me. And so we had to kind of walk through the technology process to realize that what it was is it was her computer. Right. She was running a much older computer that the card that we put in it was faster than the computer was even capable of really working with. Right. And so she was riding a bicycle down this, you know, information superhighway, the internet, and that was why it was slow. And so those types of experiences, I guess, through history are what sort of helped prepare me for these types of conversations that we have now. Right. I mean, they've changed from that, because most everybody's computer, I mean, you can buy a $300 computer at Staples and it'll still run on, you know, a reasonable ADSL or SHA connection without any kind of impedance. Right. The conversations have shifted from that to, you know, I want to do voice, and I hear that voice over IP is the way to go. Can I just throw this on my existing SHA connection? And it's like, well, right. You could. It's right. Probably going to be a very bad experience for you, but you could.
Right.
To do this properly, how do we want to do this? We want to take that voice traffic. We want to separate it out between, you know, the stuff that's your YouTube surfing and whatever on lunch breaks, and make it so that it's got its own dedicated path in your network. And to do that, we need to upgrade a few things. We need to look at your switches. We need to look at your internet and figure out how do we properly segment these two things so that they don't interact with one another. It's like oil and water, right? So this is where conversations have shifted to now, is these types of things. And I think, you know, it's hard to say, like, this is the magic bullet, or this is the one thing that I use and constantly go back to in these conversations. But I just try to find, you know, things that are out there in the real world that just have a similar conceptual background to, you know, the technology problem that they're having. You know, when you use the phrase riding a bicycle down a hall, down a highway, like people understand what that means. It's like, you got these four lanes of free flowing traffic, but you're on a bicycle trying to keep up. Right. So the picture is worth a thousand words when it comes to those things. And really that's sort of the strength in architecture, is being able to simplify the problem, help business people understand that so that they can help, you know, influence a decision in a particular direction.
Sure. Sure. So I know you've focused on the Open Group Architectural Framework, which, you know, colloquially is called TOGAF in the industry. Why did you choose TOGAF?
You know, there's a lot of different sort of, I guess, standards or frameworks or things that you can choose from the IT world. A lot of people will have heard of things like ITIL or TOGAF or Zachman or what are some other ones? COBIT. There's a number of these different frameworks. And really, like, when you look at ITIL is this sort of, it's almost a process-based, how do we continuously improve our ability to help our organization through IT? And it sort of has come up from the inside of IT to say, you know, if we're seeing this same problem over and over and over again, what can we as IT behind the scenes do to fix that? Right. It's not really a framework that lends itself well to directly engaging with the business in those types of conversations. It's one that's more of an internal IT process. Right. And so, you know, seeing the problem that I was seeing, which is that it's really more a challenge between the business and IT being able to articulate where each other is coming from to get to a more unified, I guess, answer to the problem. That's where sort of TOGAF fit in. It has this similar sort of cyclical process whereby you're constantly doing iterations to improve the organization, but it really relies on working intrinsically with the business to come up with the best solution versus just going internally to fix something that maybe was broken and should have been right to begin with.
Sure.
So it's the frameworks all tend to sort of fit and overlap a little bit with one another. If you drew sort of a Venn diagram, you could kind of start with your PM Bok and COBIT and stuff over here, and then sort of filters into TOGAF and ITIL on the back end as part of the service organization. They all kind of have overlaying little bits and pieces. But it generally, from a TOGAF perspective, just made the most sense to me, because that's the space that I see the biggest struggle in. The biggest resistor to technology change is in that misunderstanding between those technicians and the business people that need to provide the money to do the projects, right?
Yeah, I mean, it seems fair to say that if I... if we talk about solutions and technology and all these things, I guess I'll phrase it as a question. Is it fair to say that the biggest gap that you see in technology is just that technology people, or people who have, that I had mentioned before, who have been long-term technology people, have a hard time articulating actual need from a business perspective to business people?
Well, and you know, it's that, but it's also, you get all these new kids that are coming up now that, you know, there's an app for that, and there's an app for that, and there's an app for that. And so you have this combination of these old school IT people that are like, well, we just need to add more big things to the network and then things will work better for you. And then you get these little whippersnappers that are like, yeah, I know how to do that. We'll use this app and that app, and then we'll plug them in together and like do this little interchange, and this one will feed that one. And the next thing you know, you've created a custom developed application essentially out of all these little strung together applications without actually having somebody truly understand what that path is that we're building, and is it actually getting us to the end point that the business is looking for?
Right.
So it's really a struggle on both ends from an IT perspective. But at the end of the day, both of those technicians, the old school technician and the new school technician, they both are just not really engaging properly with that end user to understand the solution that's best going to work for them.
Right. Right. There's a lot of that happening at the moment. I see it as a big challenge for many companies as well, in that, you know, just the translation between this technology is neat and cool and will accomplish all these goals, but is it appropriate for your business on this side? And that there's a lot of that that's disconnected, completely disconnected.
Right. Yeah.
So obviously you have a family, you've got kids, wife. You know, IT can be a long hour gig. How do you manage that? They just happy to have you out of the house for long hours sometimes, or?
Well, I'd like to say no, but I'm sure my wife would tell you that yes, it is nice to have her out of the house every once in a while. You know, that it's always a struggle, because as an IT guy, no matter how long you think it's going to take, there's always that extra length of time that it really takes to get the job done. I've been doing this for 20, 22 years now, and, you know, I still go out the door. I'll be telling my wife I'm going to be there for at least an hour, I think maybe an hour and a half, and she automatically knows that means it's going to be 2 or 3 hours. Yeah,
3 hours.
Exactly. 3 hours. So, you know, at the end of the day, it is a bit of a struggle. But in reality, those are some of the best times to get the real work that needs to be done, because it's the after hour stuff. It's the, you know, late night change windows where you can really properly test and make sure that the end user's use cases are all being met. You know, they this is the problem they're trying to solve. Let's test these 5 things as well, because they also are kind of around that same sort of area, and make sure that when they walk in the morning that everything's going to be up and running and that you've got a smooth transition. And so, you know, family life, they tend to struggle with that a little bit, just because it means that you're going to be away from the office. But the reality is that they understand too, that that's when you're making the best progress for the customer, the best progress for the company that you're working for, in getting things done and really helping them solve a real problem, is when you're doing that late night stuff. So,
right. The challenge for technology people like you and I, and I'm kind of the old school, is that even if they had told me that there was going to be ridiculously long hours, the counter from my side would be, but there's cool things to be done. And, you know, ultimately you have to achieve balance in there somewhere. And you know, you get to
that's where the family trips to Jamaica and Hawaii come in. I mean,
right.
You have to balance these things, right? You're putting in late hours, you know, getting change windows done. You reward the family by taking them somewhere decent. Lots of ways to do that.
Right. Absolutely. So, what about the technology? Is there anything like Is there anything you prefer to work on as far as technology? Are you prefer to be in development projects? You prefer to be in you know, storage projects, server projects, or do you just not care?
At this point, I found that the broad use case, the broad spectrum of things, I find that generally architecture and infrastructure specifically projects. So when I say infrastructure, storage, network, server, cloud is sort of now the new infrastructure. Those types of projects are of most interest to me. You know, making systems talk amongst all of those different pieces is really kind of where I focus right now. But I also find that, you know, spending time just mentoring people, you know, being sort of that team lead, tech lead, helping those young guys sort of, you know, temper down that use, overuse of, you know, the latest app, and help them understand how these apps really are meant to communicate and how they're meant to work within the confines of IT,
right,
is another sort of strength that I have. Where you don't want me is you don't want me in that programmer space. I, you know, Quick Basic was my introduction. I did a little bit of Turbo Pascal in high school. Did some VB stuff very, very early on in my career. And I know enough of the programming that I can talk to a developer. I can work through the challenge the developer's having, and I truly have an understanding for what it is they're talking about. But my version of code was an array. What's that? I'm just going to copy paste this line of code 20 times in my thing. And it was not pretty.
Right.
My developer friends have all told me, Rod, it's good that you're on the infrastructure side, because you would not cut it on the developer side.
thankfully so, I guess.
Yeah.
That's a whole other world to talk about.
Absolutely.
So, you know, we're kind of just reaching our end of time here. What do you do for fun? Like, what? Describe a little bit about what Rod does in his downtime.
Sure. So, you know, when it's vacation time, it's all about scuba diving. I try to do as much of that as I can when I'm on vacation. When it's home time here, it's a mix of some voiceover work. I try to get myself out there as being, you know, somebody who can record good audio and help companies develop training content and things like that. And balancing that off with some video game playing and you know, playing with my daughter and keeping the family life going as well. Beyond that, IT really fills all the other gaps.
right. So your side gig is literally doing voiceover work. So that's,
you bet.
I mean, that's an interesting. How much time does that take up?
It depends on the contract, because there are some really small jobs that are just like, hey, we need somebody to record our voicemail messages so that, you know, thank you for calling such and such company. You've reached, you know, Tim's hotline. Press 1 for sales, press 2 for this. And those little gigs can, you know, last a couple of hours in an evening, you know, after the kid's down in bed and the house is nice and quiet. You can knock off maybe two of those projects before heading to bed. Some of the other ones where it's more training material, you know, you're the voice that's coming on and saying, and now you're going to pick up that vial of hydrogen peroxide. You know, hydrogen peroxide may not be the safest element to be working with. So here's some things you should know about hydrogen peroxide.
Right.
And those ones can take, you know, a couple of hours every night for a week, you know, to kind of crank out the content that they need. It's funny because a lot of people think, well, you know, it's just a 10-second recording, like you should be able to bang that out like that. But, you know, you watch all the blooper reels on TV and you realize that still takes, you know, it's for a 10-second clip, it's maybe an hour to an hour and a half worth of recording just to make sure you've got all the little iterations of how you might want to hear that sound. And then whatever post-production, so another hour or two of post-production just to clean it up and get rid of all the little breath sounds and things that are in there, just so it sounds good, right?
So. Absolutely. Having worked this podcast now and done several episodes, I went down a road of that type of diligence. But spending that many hours to clean things up and you know, cut things to make sure they sounded correct, I'm just not at that level of cleanliness. And I apologize to everyone who listens to this podcast. I understand how rough this podcast is. That said, it's a lot of work. So, you know,
take it slow. Because there's a whole other career path there called audio engineer, and you know those guys make boatloads of money. But again, similar to architecture, they have a very niche skill set that is pretty unique in the audio world, and it takes them years of study to get to being good at what they do as well.
Right.
You got to balance that.
Right. And in Canada, you're probably having to live in Vancouver, and for me, that's a downside. So no thanks.
The Cuyahoga of Canada is, or no, we can't go that bad with
you. Yeah, it's not a river that's on fire, but you know, it's not a preferred place. It is still in Canada, so it's not in the States. So I do have to love that about it, but yeah, no, not for me. Thank you. All love to Vancouver, but not for me. Thank you. All right, so we're pretty much out of time for today. Thanks for joining us, Rodney, and I'm glad we got to know you a little bit better. And you know, if you have questions or you want to talk to Rodney about voiceover work or you want to talk to Rodney about architecture, please reach out to me at or to Technology Advisory Professionals at podcast@tapintotech.com. Again, that's podcast@tapintotech.com. We would be more than happy to set up that connection. There's plenty of things we can do there. All right. Hopefully you have a great night, Rodney, and we'll talk to you soon.
You bet. Take care.
Awesome. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this TAP One-on-One podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or would just like more information, please feel free to reach out to us at podcast@tapintotech.com. If you have any questions for me, Sean Gange-Harris, my email address is sgangeharris@tapintotech.com. You can find us on LinkedIn, Twitter, YouTube, and at www.tapintotech.com. Music provided today by www.bensound.com. We hope you come back and find out more about the great people who contribute to technology, innovation, and growth. Thanks again.